it was until 1987 when Carla and I got serious about wanting to do a zine that looked at things like cyberpunk science fiction and underground comics and brain machines, psychedelia. And so we were living in LA at the time when we did it. And we thought, let's interview Robert Anton Wilson, who was a writer we really liked. Let's review like books by Rudy Rucker and William Gibson and Bruce Sterling. And so the name, at the time there were a lot of comic books and some zines that had names that were like sound effects, like honk and blab, buzz. And so I thought Boing Boing is a good one because I really like the character Gerald McBoing Boing.
This time on the Plutopia News Network podcast, Mark Frauenfelder joins John and Scoop in the virtual studio. Mark discusses the creation of Boing Boing, one of the pioneering zines and later a popular blog. We also discuss his work as founding editor of Wired.com, journalism, and much more.
Plutopia News Network welcomes Mark Frauenfelder, who's currently research director at the Institute for the Future. Mark's been an influential and vital part of the mainstreaming of the internet over the years. He was editor at Wired Magazine and Make Magazine, and he was the founder of the Boing Boing blog. And earlier on, before that, he started the popular Boing Boing zine, which the blog was derived from, I guess we would say. It became the web version of the zine and then became the blog. And I actually
remember, which you were an editor of.
Yeah, I was an editor of the Boing Boing zine. And I remember when you moved the zine to the web, which made absolute sense. And then I remember getting an email from you where you were really excited about this new thing called Blogger. And you were going to try it out and you were going to put Boing Boing on Blogger. And I guess that's where the Boing Boing blog got its start.
Yeah, it was. It was actually kind of an accident because I was writing, it was in 1999, and I started learning about web blogs. And at that time, I think there were like 300 web blogs like cataloged from some index. And I thought, this seems like something that's happening. So I was writing on contract for the Industry Standard magazine at the time.
Oh yeah.
And I told my editor if I could, you know, I said I should cover this because I think it's an interesting story. So they said, okay. So I interviewed a whole bunch of people who had blogs, and then I sent in the article, and they're like, well, you know, we don't think that there's really like a business readers, you know, the people who read Industry Standard are interested in internet business. There's not really a business kind of application for blogs. So, but as part of my like learning, I just put Boing Boing on the Blogger to see if I could make it work and understand what blogging was about. So even though the article never ran, Boing Boing got it, you know, it moved from being just a static website to a blog. So that ended up being a good thing.
I'm glad you mentioned Industry Standard. I remember the way that I could gauge the impact of the dot-com bust was that Industry Standard went from being about 4 inches thick to being like a little skinny publication before it finally went away. And that was John, right? John Battelle?
Right. That was Battelle. And the funny thing was that after the Industry Standard folded, then John, who was a publisher of the Industry Standard, became the ad sales person for Boing Boing.
I remember that. Federated Media. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So from thinking that blogs... He wasn't the one who made the decision to kill the article, but, you know, an editor there did. But anyway, yeah. And so
you
that
killed
was,
one of my articles, too, for Wired. You remember that?
Which one was that about?
That was the one where, it was a book about hackers. Now I can't remember the name of the book. Mm-hmm. I think it was one of those small press books. Anyway, you had sent the thing over to me and I reviewed it, but... I mentioned that we got into some discussion about how I was saying that the Steve Jackson raid was not part of Operation Sun Devil. Mm-hmm. And you had somebody else who had written an article that said it was part of Operation Sun Devil. And I don't know, we had an exchange about that. Mm-hmm. And it was Josh Quitner that had written the other article. And I think he ended up changing his reference, and we know you ended up deciding not to publish the thing that I wrote. I can't remember exactly why. I don't even know why I remember this.
That's funny. I think Wired probably has one of the high, I don't know if it still does, but back then it had one of the highest kill rates. We've probably assigned 2 to 3 times as many pieces as we ran, which is not really a good thing to do. And there was also and I think this still persists, kind of a hierarchy of editors where pieces can go really far down the developmental process before they get nixed by someone at the top, which often happened. I know, I remember somebody wrote a really long, cool article, and the editor-in-chief at the time, I don't want to say who, but it was like ready to go to press, and then the editor said, "This has fractals in it. Fractals are old news. We don't want anything to do with it." It was like a cool thing about like fractal photography and compression. But anyway, that's magazines for you. And I mean, look at how Wired is now. Speaking of skinny magazines, Wired has been at like 96 pages an issue.
Yeah.
For the last 4 or 5 years, I think. It's just, I think really it's a loss leader for the conventions that they used to have before the pandemic.
It's interesting to hear your exchanges, because that reminds me of my time as a field reporter for radio news and the times that I would bring in this marvelous story that never heard the air. And my favorite one was, I came in after a big demonstration where they were using tear gas, and I came in wearing a gas mask and smelling like enough tear gas to clear out the office. And it was a great story in my mind, and it never saw the light of day. But the good thing about journalists, people generally didn't hold grudges, because that's just the nature of the beast. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah. And I have plenty of friends here in Los Angeles who make good livings as screenwriters, and they've never had a single script produced. You know, it's like a lot of great stuff never sees the light of day.
Yeah, I remember that about some of the science fiction writers that I know who were making a lot of money from treatments that never went anywhere.
Yeah, I think that's why, you know, our mutual friend Bruce Sterling is happy to have his stories optioned and have people look at them and stuff. But he's just like, he wants nothing to do with the Hollywood machine, because, you know, 9 times out of 10, it's not going to go anywhere.
Hey, I remember the name of the book that I was going to review that time. Mm-hmm. It was Secrets of a Super Hacker.
Who
remember
wrote
that?
It?
It was written by an anonymous author who listed himself as Nightmare, with Night starting as with a K, K-N-I-G-H-T-M-A-R-E. Mm-hmm. And it had an introduction by Gareth Branwen, our friend.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and I think that's how you stumbled onto it. And I think maybe the reason you decided not to run the review of it was partly because of the anonymity.
Yeah, that's always a big red flag for any kind of journalism when it's unacknowledged. That's kind of a risky place to be.
Yeah. It was kind of a weird book, too. Anyway, be that as it may, I want to back up a little bit. I want to talk to you about Boing Boing the Zine, because I don't think I've ever asked you this question before. What really led you to start a zine?
Okay, yeah. So let me think about that just a little bit. It really was, I think it was probably the Whole Earth Review had an article by Janine Carlston, I believe is her name. And she wrote an article about zines. And I think this was 1985 or 1986. And it sounded really cool to me, this whole idea that there was this zine of zines called Factsheet 5, which was kind of like the Yahoo directory of zines. People would send their zines into this guy named Mike Gunderloy, and he would review hundreds of zines and put out this quarterly zine. And so I ordered a copy of it and just got my yellow highlighter out and just started highlighting all the zines that looked interesting. And then I sent in and ordered them. It was really exciting. I mean, it was a lot like personal blogs in the day, these highly individual, personal publications. And I thought it sounded really appealing and fun to me. So I started by doing mini comics, and I did a few different mini comics and a few like kind of false start zines. And then I think it was finally, it was until 1987 when Carla and I got serious about wanting to do a zine that looked at things like cyberpunk science fiction and underground comics and brain machines, psychedelia. And so we were living in LA at the time when we did it. And we thought, let's interview Robert Anton Wilson, who was a writer we really liked. Let's review like books by Rudy Rucker and William Gibson and Bruce Sterling. And so the name, at the time there were a lot of comic books and some zines that had names that were like sound effects, like honk and blab, buzz. And so I thought Boing Boing is a good one because I really liked the character Gerald McBoing Boing.
Mr. McBoing's buddy.
Yeah. Yeah. A UPA cartoon. And I love that kind of mid-century modern art design of the UPA studios. And so that was just a good choice for us. And then we ended up moving to Colorado while we were producing it. And I think the first issue came out in 1988. And it was like only 32 pages long. And when it came out, we really didn't know if we would do another one, but someone saw it in New York, a zine distributor, like a magazine, small press magazine distributor, and asked for 100 copies of the next issue. And we had done 100 of the first issue, so we printed 200 copies, and Mike Gunderloy reviewed it. And so we basically doubled the circulation of every issue, until finally, I think the last issue was issue number 15, and we had a print run of over 17,000.
Wow.
But the big distributors, it was good. But the problem was the big distributors that were doing zines, that was like, I can't remember their names now. There were two of them, and they both declared bankruptcy, and they owed us. They had not been paying us for a long time. And so we were like left, expecting to get tens of thousands of dollars from them. But
yeah, we
never
were affected by that too, as friends with you.
Yeah, I'm sure.
That was one of those distributors was based everybody. Here in Austin, right?
Yeah, was it called Fine Print or what
Fine
was
Print.
The name of
them? It was Fine
Print.
Yeah,
Fine Print. Yeah,
I think that they had, I seem to recall hearing that somebody, they had an employee who embezzled some money or something like that. I think that was
interesting.
The problem that they had. I'm not really
so
sure. That was kind
money.
Of secondhand. I did. I later worked with somebody who had been part of the team over at Fine Print, and she told me a few stories.
That was back in the day when many companies were going under because someone in the senior executive suite was snorting too much coke. So there were a number of people in the Bay Area that went under like that.
I don't think that was their thing, but they had some kind of financial issues. And I also recall that when I first met you, it was through The Well. And Mike Gunderloy was on The Well, too.
That's right.
And I actually became a host of the Factsheet 5 conference with him, a co-host. And I became the book reviewer for Factsheet 5. And somewhere along the line there, you asked me to be fiction editor for Boing Boing. And I don't know if you remember this, but you sent me the whole big slush file of all the fiction that had been submitted. And yeah. I wrote you back and I read through it and I said, I think you shouldn't take submissions of fiction.
Yeah.
That was the early days of fan fiction, I guess.
Exactly.
So I moved from editorship to being the cyborganic jive meister.
That's right. I love it.
Those were the days.
That's right.
So you were publishing the zine and you had a pretty good run with it, maybe not making a lot of money with it. And then at what point did you get on with Wired?
Let's see. That was in, they had called me in like late 1992, I think, or early 93, about like before they published the first issue, they were looking for a managing editor. And so they interviewed me for it, but they ended up giving the job to John Battelle, which was a good choice because he had a lot of magazine experience in, like, you know, real magazines with ad sales and, you know, kind of managerial experience. And so he got the job. And then, but I wrote for them from the first issue. And then by the third issue, they were growing. And so they asked me if I'd like to come on as an associate editor. And so we moved from Los Angeles to San Francisco, and I worked there at the office. And the building that we were in, there was space below on the first floor, and they kindly let, it wasn't Wired, but it was a guy who owned that space down there, and he let us gave us a corner office. I think it was like $100 a month, or it was free or something.
I remember
and
that
Carla
office.
Took over the editor, like ran the magazine while I was working upstairs at Wired. And so then I stayed at Wired from like 1993 until 1998, and was like worked on the magazine for a couple of years, and then they wanted to, you know, the web was happening, and they had started Hotwired, but they wanted to give Wired the magazine a present, so they asked me if I would like to be the editor in chief of Wired.com, and so I did that. For a year or so, and then they started a book division, like a book publishing company called Hardwired, and I worked there, which was fun. And one of the cool things that I did there that I liked was a lot of the old out-of-print cyberpunk short stories and novels. I got contacted all the authors, like John Shirley and Rudy Rucker and Charles Platt, I think Mark Laidlaw, and republished their work in a line and a series of, like, you know, new editions with new introductions and things like that.
So were you still associated with Wired when Condé Nast took over?
I think so. I was. I stopped working there in 1998, and I am pretty sure they had been purchased. No, they were actually owned by Lycos for a while.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, Lycos. And then Condé Nast bought them from Lycos. So I wasn't actually there in the Condé Nast era, which is still the owner.
Well, when I first became really aware of Wired was when I found that Wired was starting to buy up all these sites that I really liked and web services. Who was behind all the acquisitions that started to happen?
Let's see. That was probably later. Like, Wired started Hotwired. I guess they were like acquiring some things, like Suck.com was actually started internally by some Hotwired employees who just kind of moonlighted and were doing it at night, and Wired bought it from them. So I would guess Louis Rossetto and Jane Metcalf, the founders of Wired, probably did some acquisition. And then when Chris Anderson was editor-in-chief later, he's very savvy. He probably bought some sites too. I think where Wired really kind of missed out was they started a search engine called Hotwired. And it was competing with Alta Vista at the time, if you remember that search engine. It was kind of like pre-Google. But they had a lot of market share early on, but they just didn't follow up with the tech development And then Google with its PageRank algorithm really like blew everything else out of the water.
Yeah,
and,
yeah, they were much better than AltaVista.
Killed everything.
Yeah, I remember that there was even a, I started getting emails from Wired's travel services. I can't remember the name of it now.
Oh, wow. I didn't know they had a travel service.
Yeah, I don't amazing. Know if it's travel or, you know, it was something monkey. I forget the name.
Oh, yeah. Like Code, I think Code Monkey or something like that. They had like a site for like developers.
Yeah, that was Code Monkey. I remember that too. I worked at Hotwired for a while. I was running Electronic Frontiers Forum, which was really kind of, it's kind of like an online discussion, kind of a chat-based discussion that we would do weekly for an hour, I think it was. And I would bring in a guest. That was kind of an interesting gig. Went on for a while. They actually, they hired me. They were going to hire me to be a forum moderator in addition to the work I was doing with the Electronic Frontiers Forum. It bothered them that when I started working as a forum moderator, I was actually starting to inject myself into the conversations, because my history in doing that kind of work was at the well, you know, where you would be a host and you would try to move the conversation along. And their idea was you would be more like a monitor. You would be silent and in the background, and you would only step in if you had to break up a fight, I guess, or something.
Oh, interesting. So it was not a participatory kind of a thing.
Yeah, exactly. So we sort of parted ways over that. I would have done what they wanted me to do, but it wasn't going to be very interesting. You know, it was going to be kind of a dull job.
Yeah, that's probably good that you... it's kind of sad to see like some of the original people who were kind of long-term contributors, like Bruce Sterling. They killed his blog that he'd been doing for many years. That was just a little while ago. And Gareth did the Jargon Watch column that was like looking at new words and stuff like that. And they got rid of that. I guess, you know, things change and they have their decisions about how they want it, the direction they want to take magazines in. So I guess that makes sense.
Well, so after you left Wired, at some point you got involved with O'Reilly and Make. Was that that was in the later 2000s, right?
Yeah, that was that was in late 2000, it was around 2003, around 2003. And again, it was John Battelle was talking to Dale Doherty, one of the co-founders of O'Reilly, and because Dale had called him in. Dale was an editor there at O'Reilly and one of the founders, and he had been doing a series of books called the Hacks Books that were kind of about hardware hacking, and he had things like eBay hacks, Amazon hacks, baseball hacks. And so he wanted to create a magazine, a general interest magazine about making things, which I thought, it was such a great idea. And so John called me and asked if I would be interested in helping with it. And so I came up there and met with Dale, and he asked me to put together a prototype of what the magazine might look like a 50 page mini issue of what the magazine might be. And so we brainstormed on a name. Dale was the one who came up with the name Make, which I wasn't so sure of at first, but it turned out to be such a great name. And so I hired a designer that I really liked, this guy named David Albertson, who did a lot of design work for the TED conferences and did some work for a Wired spinoff magazine. And so I basically camped out at David Albertson's office for about 2.5 weeks, and we made a fake early issue of Make magazine. And Dale would come up once a week or so and review the pages taped to the wall, And so I thought, you know, it was just a one-off gig. He was going to pay me to produce this prototype. And then, you know, it was like, all right, have fun, you guys, with it. But he ended up calling and asking if I'd like to stay on as the editor in chief of it. And I loved the idea so much that I did. And I was there from, I think, like, late 2003 or early 2004 up until, I think, maybe 2014. It was like, so I was there about 10 years, or maybe it was even 12 years. It might have been until 2016. It gets kind of hazy.
It seems like it was a pretty long run. So did you consider yourself a maker?
Less at first, and then more as I went on. And I think it was because I was just around these people who were makers. And at first I was like just so impressed and intimidated by how good they were at making things. Everything from furniture to electronics and everything in between, that I just thought there's no way I could ever, make something that would be comparable. And what I did learn, though, from like working with these people and visiting them and seeing them at maker fairs, was that like their super skill wasn't as much talent as it was about not being afraid to make mistakes and just being persistent and like accepting mistakes and learning from them. And that a lot of it is just trial and error and just, you know, endless iterations and prototypes and starting over. And so once I gave myself the freedom to like just screw up over and over and over again, I was able to like really enjoy the process of making. And now it is like a pretty significant part of my life. I have like a laser cutter and a 3D printer and a bunch of tools. And so I still do everything from, you know, lots of electronics projects with Raspberry Pis and Arduinos to whittling spoons, which is, you know, I have like a bunch of wood and some carving tools that I have outside on my porch. And I'll just take a break and just, you know, carve a spoon for 5 or 10 minutes while I wait for my coffee to get cool enough to drink.
I like what you said.
With Make Magazine right now, is it still being published?
Yeah, it's still being published.
I know the Maker Fair stopped, right? They're not doing Maker Fair anymore.
Unfortunately, they're working on trying to get it going again. But they went under in a way. I mean, they kind of folded Make for a month or two, and Dale was able to get the trademark for it and own it just himself. And so he has restarted it, and he's doing it. It's not a nonprofit, but I think that's probably something that, you know, he would be wanting to look into. And so it's around and it's still being published. And I think that, there's still maker fairs around the world.
Oh, they still have one in Austin.
That's good. Yeah. So I think they license the name. You know, you can have mini maker fairs, kind of, there's like exactly. A TEDx kind of model. And then there's like, you know, a more official model where I think they pay a licensing fee and they get, you know, best practices and consultation and all that kind of stuff. So it's still going, which I'm really glad to hear.
I know it was an expensive event to put on.
Yeah. And it's also really dependent on getting large corporate sponsors. And if one or two big sponsors drop out, it really like affects the bottom line in a severe way. And so that's, you know, that's the hard thing. And if there's like a kind of a dry year, then it's a big hit.
Yeah, there was a Plutopia event at one time. One of our large corporate sponsors was Make Magazine, by the way. Early
oh, really?
On, I think our first Plutopia. And I think that's Scoop a minute ago. Scoop, you were going to say something.
I was just impressed by what you said about not being afraid to fail. And that's something that doesn't get taught enough to people. So many people are indoctrinated that you can't fail. You have to get it right all the time.
Yeah. And
I've gotten some of my best knowledge from screwing up. And it stays
so
with you a lot longer than getting it right. You know, getting it right is great, and you should get it right when you can. But being afraid to fail prevents so many people from going further in whatever it is they do, it doesn't really matter what field you're in. And I've taught that to people that I've trained in studio work, and even back in my reporting days, of don't be afraid, just go and do it, and if you screw up, learn from it.
Sunryu Suzuki Roshi, the Zen master, used to say that life is one continuous mistake.
That's great.
Yeah.
I love that. And I think, you know, one of the problems is that kids are taught in school that mistakes equal a bad grade. And that's like bad training, because then, you know, you go through life thinking that mistakes equate to something that's really a negative thing that can hurt you. And it's so, I think the grading system is a bad system. And, you know, there's a lot of problems with the way that the educational system works, of course, but the grades are like a big problem with it, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two kinds of people in this world. There's people who are kind of honest about their mistakes, and then there's people who hide their mistakes. But there's not any people who don't make mistakes.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, we have a president that doesn't make any mistakes, according to his press releases.
Yeah. Exactly. I know. I just imagine if he were like ever willing to admit to making mistakes, I think that it would make such a huge difference in his effectiveness as a leader and the way he's perceived. But the fact that he won't ever do that makes him really, you know, much more dangerous.
Yes, John and I have been attending a webinar this week of International Society for Online Journalism, listening to
International Symposium for Online
Journalism. Yes, Symposium. And they have journalists from all over the world talking about COVID-19 and other subjects, but that's been a big focus of just about everything I've listened to lately is, you know, these journalists are puzzled at what's going on in our country. And, you know, they had people from Germany. You know, the only ones that weren't too puzzled were the journalists from India and Brazil, which are having similar problems that we've experienced here.
Yeah.
And they have similar governance.
It's really sad. And it's that kind of stubbornness that a lot of people have not wearing masks. Like, I've been to Japan quite a few times, and even before the pandemic, people wore masks. And so they were totally on board. Everyone wears masks there. And they've had, the entire country has had fewer than 1,000 deaths. And the unemployment rate is like less than 2.5%. I mean, look at the difference. It's insane. Oh, yeah.
Well, in your work at the Institute for the Future, how has that work changed since March?
I mean, it's changed in a big way. The office is all but closed down. We have an office in Palo Alto, California, but, you know, we don't allow any, we only allow like one person in there at a time. And it's usually our art director who is, you know, wants to just have like the giant screen and a color printer. But other than that, everyone is using Zoom. All of our work, our workshops that we do are all done using Zoom. We've started using this app called Miro, M-I-R-O, which is this amazing, I mean, if I say whiteboard, that's short selling it too much, because there's just this kind of infinitely expandable space to put interactive workshops together, and people can collaborate. You can break off into subgroups, but it's done in such a way to make it really intuitive and not complicated. And so starting to use Miro is like, it's just been such a great way to really make workshops that used to be live and in person work just as well virtually. And maybe I shouldn't say just as well, effectively and in different, you know, in a different way, but very effective still at the same time. So we've been doing that, and, you know, our our other work for other clients, a lot of times are reports, and we're able to do that and do all of our interviews, you know, analysis and all that kind of stuff, just collaboratively. I spend much more time on Zoom than I ever have, you know, doing video conferences, which is, can be a little exhausting at times. You know, how do you guys feel about constantly being on video?
We're kind of used to it. I mean, I've been working with, so I was part of a co-op until recently, until I retired from that. And we had all of our meetings using Zoom, using video, and had done that for years, really.
Yeah,
And then Scoop and I have done, we did a large percentage of our interviews using Zoom because we would so often interview people who were, you know, remote from Austin.
Yeah, in the early days, we started out with Skype, which was interesting. But I mean, we listened in today is a webinar. They had NBC's people talking about their change from having all the massive camera crews and live stuff out there to working the way we've been working since like 2010. So it was interesting hearing that. I'm like, well, I remember those days when we had to figure out how to do these interviews over the internet. But it's quite comfortable. Yeah, I prefer going. I'm an old beat reporter from back in the radio days, and I like going out and being face-to-face with the person you're interviewing. You get so much more of a read for where they're coming from and where they're going by being in person.
Right.
But with the Zoom camera, I mean, pretty close. I can see you quite well, so it works. But I'd sure like to be out there.
Yeah, definitely. Well, hopefully we will be able to again soon.
I was just answering a question on a survey today, one of those Pew surveys where they, one of the things they're wondering about is how will whatever is going on now have an impact on technology. And they made me think about it. And what I was thinking is that this is probably here to stay. And a concern about, even if the coronavirus is managed to some extent, I think that we're sufficiently snake bit that we're going to continue to be concerned about other possible vectors of exposure to other things. And that some of the things that we're doing now, like wearing masks and having virtual conversations and meetings, will probably stick to some extent.
I think you're probably right. Yeah.
Do you actually do strategic foresight work yourself, or are you more managing and coordinating?
I do some strategic foresight. I do. I'm also the editorial director there, so I'm responsible for all the deliverables, you know, everything that we produce, just making sure that the editorial integrity is there. And so I help with that. I help with, production, design, all that stuff. But I also do, you know, some research, and I'll, you know, do expert interviews and signal scanning, synthesis, all that kind of stuff. So it's a small company, so a lot of people wear a lot of different hats.
One of the things I keep hearing on this webinar is the concept of flattening the organization. And I recall that from back in the day when offshoring became the big thing. Everybody wanted to flatten the local organization, which means you have less people to pay, less mouths to feed. And I have a feeling we're headed in that same direction in many industries. If people go, well, you know, we were able to do that with this few people. Do we need to bring all these folks back? Are you hearing that sort of thing?
I think so. I mean, you know, this is coming at a time when the whole kind of gig economy marketplace has been growing and evolving. And so I think we'll start to see more and more of this kind of you know, marketplaces for automatically, you know, finding who you need to get a job done. And, you know, companies will expand and contract on an as needed basis. And that's why I think it's really more important than ever to think about things like, the current wealth and equity issues that we have, benefits, healthcare, all these kinds of things, which, you know, in decades past, certain segments of the population did have a semblance of security. I think we have a challenge, opportunity, and a duty now to see what we can do to make life more equitable for everybody. And maybe there is a way to combine gig economy with things like portable benefits, so that if you know, do something for TaskRabbit or Uber or Upwork, that all is kind of combined in a way that the work you put into it goes to, you know, you get some kind of benefits, or, you know, retirement or an investment plan or something like that. I think there's possibilities out there. It's going to take a ton of work to do, but it's, you know, no time like the present to start exploring that, especially when we are kind of in shock, in a way that allows us to think, you know, let's think what we can do with a blank slate here, make this work.
That's a very good point. I have a friend actually in the Bay Area who never really worked for anyone other than himself. And he's at retirement age and realizing that he really doesn't have the benefits of the, like, you know, people who worked for a company and had Social Security and all that coming to them. And that's what I see happening to the gig economy, is people are working, but they're not getting any benefits for later on.
Yeah. Go ahead, John.
Oh, I was just going to say the company that you worked for at one point in this country was sort of like your home and family, you know, it was providing you more than just a place where you went to work every day and drew a paycheck. They did more to take care of you, and you really felt a sense that you belong there. And that's sort of disappearing now. And I think, several years ago, I took my own sole proprietorship and turned it into a cooperative, and had other people who came in as members. And to me, that is a good step forward, something mm-hmm. that we might do as an alternative to the way things were done before, and especially as an alternative to the way things are being done commonly now, is to form cooperatives. And in cooperatives, everybody's an owner, and all the people can be dedicated to the good of everybody else, you know?
I love that idea. And it's a better solution, I think, than guaranteed basic income. Is kind of like a continual hand-to-mouth solution. But guaranteed basic assets, where you have actual ownership of shared intellectual property, physical property, real estate, your own data that these social media platforms own, having that kind of ownership, so you have guaranteed basic assets, that is I think the secret sauce, and cooperatives could be a big part of that solution.
Yeah, it's for some people it could be a difficult path, and it has, you know, its own set of gotchas. One thing is that if everybody's an owner, you really have to make sure everybody sort of fits together and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's a very sane way to hold yourself within some kind of enterprise, and you can make money just like you can make money with other kinds of business. You're not going to have the one guy at the top who's making millions more than anybody else in the company, but that income will be distributed in such a way that everybody is okay, you know?
Yeah, I think that's good. And that's also like one other thing that's crazy about the U.S. is that, you know, the difference in percentage of how much the CEO makes is like many, many multiples of the rank and file employees. But like Japan, it's really like there's much less disparity between the CEO and the other employees. And so that's another thing that ought to be corrected.
They just published a list of the highest paid people in education and upper management, the chancellors and presidents of various universities. Texas had a large portion of that list, people that were heading up, you know, University of Texas or Texas A&M, making, you know, $1.5 million a year. And you talk to the people that are teaching in those institutions, they're not anywhere close to that.
So Scoop, the football coach, makes $5 million a year.
Yeah. Student debt is another huge, huge, huge problem where young people just starting out in life are saddled with debt that they won't be able to pay off for decades. That's a ridiculous.
Yeah, it was great that Bernie was trying to address that, and I hope that some of that filters into, assuming that Biden is elected president, that, I mean, somehow that needs to be reformed. I know when I was going to school, you accumulated some debt, but I didn't have unmanageable debt, you know, from my student loans. And we were able to get grants as well as loans, you know, that would offset some of that.
Yeah. It's not like that anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. It's tough. My grandson always tells me that he doesn't want to go to college because he's afraid that he'll be saddled with debt for the rest of his life.
And that's probably true. I show my age when I tell people I paid $75 a quarter for tuition at the University of North Texas, which was, you know, even then a well-known university. But you go there now and you could probably buy a nice Maserati with what you spend.
Yeah. Isn't it crazy?
So, Mark, I did some work with the Governance Futures Lab at IFTF, and I'm wondering if they're still operating and if there's still a lot of meetings going on about potential scenarios for governance.
There is, but I don't think there's a great deal that's like active at the moment, but you know, in recent years we have right now we're looking kind of looking at like post-pandemic scenarios that do include some kind of, you know, new governance models and things like that, there's nothing that's big right now actually that I can recall offhand.
Well, what does a generic post pandemic scenario sound like?
Well, I mean, you know, one thing that we do is like there's this kind of traditional way of looking at four different scenarios. One is you know, growth, another is constraint, another is collapse, and another is transformation, so that we have four different stories that kind of look at, you know, what would happen if this pandemic just gets worse and worse and worse with no end in sight? What happens if it gets under control but never eradicates? What happens if, you know, something completely kind of thinkable happens, almost like a transformational thing? And then I can't remember the fourth one, but anyway, so you know, what we do is to create those, and we talk to experts in a whole bunch of different fields, everything from art, science, the economy, and get their take on things and ask them what's possible, what's probable, and then start thinking of like second order effects, like what happens as a result of, you know, schools staying closed for the next 4 years? Like, what are some second order effects of that? Like, how would businesses change? How would transportation change? And then once we do all that kind of stuff, then we write these scenarios, and they could be anywhere from, you know, like 500 words to 5,000 words. We might give that information or findings to a science fiction writer and tell her to him or her to write a science fiction story based on that. And so the idea is not really to predict the future, but to kind of like stretch thinking and kind of help organizations become future ready by showing them what's possible, what's potentially likely to happen. So I don't know if that completely answered your question, but that's kind of the process. And we're actually, one reason I can't give you a specific example yet is we don't really have all the scenarios completely developed yet. But I do think they'll be public when they come out, and they should be up pretty soon in the next month or two, and you would be able to check them out at the website, which is iftf.org.
Oh, that'd be great. I always thought that the real purpose of, at least when you're doing like corporate futurism, is to lay out some scenarios to be kind of like a map. And then, like, if you're doing it for a corporation and you're focusing on their industry, they can kind of get a sense of where their industry could be going, and it gives them a way to make some decisions and take some actions, partly to create the future that makes the most sense to them.
Mm-hmm. That's a really great way to describe that, John.
So is anyone doing a scenario, you know, the ultimate scenario of, well, what do we do now that the dystopian nightmare is here and we can't get rid of it?
I think that as far as I know, you know, no, but that is something that should be explored, you know, along with the other possibility of being hit with some other kind of a pandemic at the same time, like a, you know, some kind of flu, another flu, or some other epidemiological event. How would that affect things? That would be pretty bad.
It could be. And, you know, we have flu season coming up, so there will inevitably be cases of flu interspersed with the existing COVID cases, which are just getting worse right now.
Yeah.
I saw a map today that showed that pretty much with very few exceptions, almost every state in the country is either having an uptick or a real surge.
Yeah. I think the last time I checked, we're on track today to have more deaths today than any time since like the end of May. So it's definitely going back up.
Yeah, it's hard to feel cheerful right now.
Yeah, it really is.
So you're living in LA now?
Yeah. Still? We're here in we've been here for quite a while, and we enjoy it. Carla's, my wife's mother lives here, and her sister. So we have family. We have friends here. We work from home, so we don't need to deal with the commute, which is great. And in fact, I mean, as horrible as this pandemic has been for us, you know, like one upside is that we have to drive even less than we have before. And so that's nice. We just take a lot of walks, spend a lot of time in our backyard. We don't go to restaurants or anything like that. We kind of minimize as much as possible.
So is LA handling this in a pretty sane way? Are they keeping cases down?
No, they're not. LA County, I think, is doing really bad. And I just shake my head whenever, on those occasions when I do have to get in the car, you know, maybe once a week or so, and I drive past the restaurants. They're filled with people, but, you know, the outdoor seating. For a while, they were having like limited indoor seating, but they're just packed. No one's wearing masks. And I'm just thinking, this is not good.
I just read that LA County has had 5,700 stolen vehicles just in the months of April and May, which is like the greatest number in recent decades. And one of the reasons is, you can't go to jail when they, you've probably seen all the police chases that have been so popular on LA TV. Mm-hmm. We even get them online. And lately, the sheriff and the LAPD don't really stick with it very long because they know that as soon as this person is arrested, they're given a citation and sent out to the streets because they don't want to put them into jail. So the word has gotten out, it's okay to steal because all you can do is get a ticket. It's like it's like marijuana used to be. You used to go to jail for it, but then they started giving you parking tickets for it.
Yeah. So it's like car theft has been decriminalized.
Pretty much, just by the nature of the beast that we're in.
That's amazing.
Yeah, these are strange times for sure.
Yeah.
Well, I think we're kind of at the end of our time here, Mark. And really appreciate you joining us.
Yeah.
And we hope you'll come back sometime.
Yeah, I'd love to. Thank you so much.
You may follow Mark's work at boingboing.net or on Twitter as @Freudenfelder. You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lubkowski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.